From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The last time my guest, critic, cultural commentator, and author, Garrick D. Kennedy, was here was for his book, Parental Discretion is Advised, The Rise of NWA and the Dawn of Gangster Rap. His new book is about somebody who, let's talk about her belief in self from an anecdote I was told once by somebody who almost worked with her. She was offered a chance to be a star in a TV show. She was auditioning for a show in the early 80s. And when she's a teenager, she said, I can't do it. I can't sign up this contract because I have my music. And the director said, well, have you sung before professionally? And she said, no. Who told you could sing? She said, well, my mother and my aunt. He says, you're going to turn down the possibility of being on the show, which may be a big deal, to go and maybe be a singer. She goes, well, yeah, I need to be able to tour. Can you let me out? And we can't do that. And so she walked away. The show she walked away from was The Cosby Show. And we're talking about Whitney Houston. My guest, Garrick D. Kennedy, just wrote a terrific new book. I think it's a personal essay and an incredible cultural history of the phenomenon of Black women in pop. The book is called Didn't We Almost Have It All? In defense of Whitney Houston. Garrick, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
There's a line, a section of the book that I think could actually also have been the title of the book. Whitney's mother said to her, heart, mind, and guts. And yeah. The book is really about the battle between these three poles in her life, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. In such a way, too, I think that, you know, so much of our misunderstanding of Whitney is really rooted in what we expected of her to be and what we wanted her to be based off of the presentation that she gave to us. But also we know that that was a presentation that wasn't entirely hers, right? And we've spent so long, you know, really unpacking that. But within that is really those complications, right? You have this woman who had a foot in the church and always wanted to sing that way, but she had this gift and this gift that she wanted to share with the world. And that did require her to, you know, shift things about herself, change things about herself, be something that she entirely wasn't on her own, but she was doing it again for the greater good of what she wanted, which is to share, you know, her talent that God had given her.
See, but I think that quote from her mother about those parts of her life, those elements, basically almost being like earth, wind, and fire. And when you write the book, they're constantly pulling at her. And I can't think of another case where somebody's written so much about subtextually about an era and using an artist to define that. Because you mentioned early in the book that, you know, kind of the two other avatars in pop at the time, Black pop, were Prince and Michael Jackson. And they were constantly being defined one way or another and fighting the definition towards conventional sexuality and Blackness.
And also with those two artists in particular, and why they come up so much, is because we also see them as serious artists. And that was sort of a thing that we didn't quite extend to Whitney, because she wasn't writing these lyrics. She wasn't producing these lyrics in the way that we traditionally know of production, even though I think as a vocal producer, she was completely underrated, you know, and not given enough credit in that regard, because she sang these songs how she wanted to sing them. And that is a level of producing on its own. But that idea of these peers that she also was helping break these, you know, barriers with, you know, you think of that MTV era at the beginning and what Michael did for that and what Whitney did for that and what Prince did for that and what Janet also. But no one studies Whitney's career, her music, her life, the way that we study Prince, the way that we study Michael. And there's so many incredible books about Prince and about Michael that gets into the weeds of their artistry and gets into the weeds of what they meant, you know, culturally. But there were none on Whitney. And that bothered me so much as somebody who loved her, but also as somebody who respected what she did and the influence that she carries. That, I mean, it goes from, you know, Brandu, who was generous enough to write the foreword, all the way to an Ariana Grande and Adele. And to have that level of influence for this long and no one taking the time to do any sort of cultural study of her, I just thought was such a disservice to this phenomenal legacy. And so many of us allowed that to continue because we were sad that she was gone. We were ashamed of how we treated her. We were really disappointed that, you know, she didn't overcome her demons in a particular way. And so I think it all became this grief that it just hung over us, that we stopped celebrating her in a particular kind of way.
Because there's so much going on in the book. And I think the thing for me that links this and parental guidance is just what that rise to fame does to Black youth who are still trying to figure out who and what they are. And we can see that both on the masculine side and in your first book. But here, I want to bring up that you're bringing up Prince and MJ, because Whitney was probably the last her generation of pop performers who wasn't perceived to be the author of her own destiny. I mean, that wasn't right. True, but she was perceived as such. And because of that, she was treated in a way by the press, and especially, as you mentioned, in the white press. And you named one of the chapters after one of the derisive terms that the Time magazine critic came up with her. He said one of her albums was bolder, blacker, and badder. You're thinking, Time magazine said this. Well, I guess
Time magazine.
Know.
Yeah. A white man, you know.
Exactly. But I mean, I thought that was interesting that for you, that's really the pain of it. To see that anybody who listened to her and to those records and to those songs, and we actually talked about this in our neighborhood. We live not far from each other. To not be able to offer the sense of authorship to her just because she didn't have the conventional credits of songwriter or producer now seems absurd.
I mean, especially when we hear these things now because we know, because, you know, because she's gone, we've had to have so many other people talking about their experiences with her, which I think is great. I think it's wonderful. But I would have loved to see a lot of that when she was here, where people are asking her, hey, so, you know, when you make the choice to sing in this phrasing, in this particular way, like, where did you get that from? And there's some that did. There's lots of those interviews. And I don't want to say that didn't exist. But there's just the overall idea that because she wasn't writing and producing in this way that we understand it, that she was not in charge. That, you know, there was this thing, particularly within our community, the Black community, that because she came from the church, because she came from this lineage of, you know, the great Cissy Houston, which, again, you know, I wanted to also have a whole chapter just on her greatness, because I felt like for so long, too many people just think of Cissy as Whitney's mom. And yes, that's accurate. But there's this other incredible lineage that she stands upon that was passed down to this woman. But I think because the surface idea of where she came from that was promoted, you know, early on, and, you know, this legacy and Dionne Warwick and all of this, there was this idea that she should be singing a particular type of music. And so when it became these really softer ballads that lean to the pop side, it was, well, I don't understand why this person is singing this. Why aren't they doing more just like deep, deep, deep soul, right? Even though her first two albums before, there was a direct shift into let's make harder R&B. There was still R&B on both those records. It's still rooted in R&B. It's still rooted in soul. She never departed from any of that. She never departed from the ways in which she sang in the church, even when she was doing those pop records. And I think that was also something that it took a long time for everybody to really connect with, was the fact that she was really pushing a tradition of singing into mainstream pop music. And being the first means that, yes, there's going to be people who don't understand it. And with that confusion becomes judgment, which we just know that's human nature. But I think about even something of now, we're seeing, you know, Kanye and Sunday Service, and just this moment of a lot of hip hop, a lot of R&B, a lot of country, a lot of other genres of music are calling back to gospel. And a lot of that is because of what Whitney did and what she introduced into the genre space.
By the way, it's a trip. My guest is Garrick D. Kennedy. His new book is, of course, Didn't We Almost Have It All, in defense of Whitney Houston. It's a terrific book. One of the things we can talk about here is that basically the penultimate verse of every song she performed almost turned gospel. It was kind of incredible. It's like she found this strength in each of these songs, this angel that was more than she could contain would come out of her, and then yeah, sort of like blend these songs back down where she started them. And I want to talk to you about that, because you allude to it so much in the book, but that combination of power and ease, and then she would just settle back down into what the song was a really an astonishing thing to me. And that's one of the things that isn't talked about so often.
It goes back to Cissy. I mean, you know, especially, God, when you just go and listen to those old records of Sissy, you know, what she was, when she was singing with her siblings, with the Drinker Singers, what she was doing, you know, with Sweet Inspirations, what she was doing with Aretha. Just, you hear the beginnings of that coming together. And I think so much about what it must have been for Whitney at, you know, 4 and 5 and 6 years old to be sitting in a studio, understanding that I have this voice and I want to sing like my mom. And this is something that I'm really, really, really liking right now. But you were watching your mom sing with Aretha Franklin. I mean, just the image of that on its own gives me chills. And I thought so much about what we learn through osmosis, right? When we think about, you know, kids in the womb, right? And that just the level of education that was being lavished upon this young woman, this young girl, there was no other road for Whitney other than being one of the greatest. I mean, if you have Dionne Warwick and, you know, you just have all of, most of your family has these God-given voices, right? And you're in the church singing a couple days a week, every single week. You know, just the level of education that comes from that. And then also the muscle that is being built, the training from Sissy of like, this is how you control it all, that breath control that we loved her for, that we were able to put a finger on it of like, oh, that's actually what she's doing. And that's why a song like I Will Always Love You is so powerful, because we know that note, when that crescendo builds, is going to knock us off our feet. We know the same way when she's doing the Star Spangled Banner. We know, because we know that song, well, we know when Whitney Houston does that song, what it's going to be toward the end. It became so much of her identity as a vocal artist that I always worried, and this was as a young child becoming a fan. Now I'm becoming, you know, I'm getting older. But as I was getting older and seeing the world and seeing how the world was treating her, the idea of the first time she's not going to be able to hit these notes, which happens to every singer, right? What are we going to do to her? And we did exactly that. When those notes couldn't come in, we already had things to say, but then there was also the personal life and there was the other things coming together. So that became part of the conversation for, you know, the last second half of her life. And that always was frustrating, because I thought what got lost in that was also this other voice that came out, this mature voice that, yes, some of it was aging, some of it was her own vices, some of it was, we all knew that she was not somebody who really, really, really liked to continue to like do vocal, you know, lessons and all the things that you need to continue to condition your voice. And so when she couldn't hit those notes in those particular ways, the way she hit them in the early 90s, we just started to really tear her apart in a different kind of way. And that was always really sad to me.
I was thinking about that one point when Clive Davis, her mentor and the man who signed her, said to her that he invoked the names Holiday, Fitzgerald, Streisand, and then Sinatra. And in certainly a couple of those cases, those people, those singers, when they lost power, they developed a technique that basically stylized the songs. But Whitney's style was to bring drama to intimacy. I mean, the songs that she's probably best known for, I Will Always Love You and The Greatest Love of All, were really intimate songs that she turned into opera.
Yeah. But I think the flip side of that, though, later in life, though, is every time she sang, it felt like that offering at church. I might not be prepared, I might not be ready, but I want to sing because I want to praise and I want to worship. And that's how she treated her songs. And I thought there was something really beautiful in that. And there was something that, you know, and Brandy writes this in the foreword where she says, you know, she always did what she needed to do, because singing was her passion. It brought her so much joy, but it was also how she was connected to God. And so I really had to think about that. I really had to think about just spirituality and what that meant to Whitney. We all knew it, but to sit and really understand it. And I think that also really helped me, especially thinking of some of the last times we saw her. What was she doing? She was singing for the Lord, right? And there's something so incredibly, yes, it breaks my heart, but it also fills me with so much joy, because She didn't care about our judgment. She had been unfortunately used to it for, at that point, what, 20 something years at that, you know, by that point in time. But it was the way in which it did not matter. She was going to always show up and sing and give that offering of praise because she was here and she was happy to be here. And that's something that is always just like stood at the front of my mind. But it's also so much of why I like, you know, a lot of those last albums that didn't get a lot of attention, because I like this other voice that she had, this more mature voice. There was this raspiness to it that it has so much soul in it. It has so much spirit. And I thought there was something really, really gorgeous about that. You know, I Look to You is, it's such a powerful record, but it's also a record that to me is Whitney doing gospel in a different way, because I know, yes, she's singing to us and she's singing to herself, but she's really singing to the Lord. And there's something about that even if you have no connection to the church, which I write about how I was one of those people, you can always be moved by that.
My guest is Garrick D. Kennedy. His new book is Didn't We Almost Have It All? In Defense of Whitney Houston. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We're making an offering with my guest, Garrick D. Kennedy. His new book is Didn't We Almost Have It All? In Defense of Whitney Houston. And those last couple of records, she was starting to develop that technique that we were talking about in the first half. But that's not what people wanted from her when they saw her live. I mean, she didn't get a chance to sort of find that, make that next step. They were waiting, partially by the end, as you write, waiting to see if she's going to be able to hit those notes that she would cough or start to sweat, mm-hmm. or her arms would start to shake on stage. It was, you felt that nakedness that she was, that was always there in the songs, but became part of the physical presentation too. That kind of vulnerability of somebody who just wasn't being given the kind of chance that she should have been given.
Yeah. And, you know, one moment that sticks out to me is, you know, the only time I got to see her live in my lifetime was during her comeback for the I Look to You era. I was covering the American Music Awards and she performed, you know, I didn't know my own strength, and just those textures in her voice where you knew behind it was a lot of pain. You know, behind it was also, yeah, pain, but a lot of joy, a lot of experience, a lot of hard lessons, a lot of shame, a lot of so much, right? But there was also that triumph that we always knew she had, and how graceful she always was, no matter what, that always shined. And to see her in that moment where, yeah, it's not the powerhouse of 92, but no one is singing the same way for all these years. Elton, none of the greats are. We all change, right? That's part of just human bodies, right? But there was something about, she is going to always be incredible because this is a unique voice, but this is also a voice that she was always singing for the Lord. And so there was something about that moment where it wasn't just for that. It was also, I want to show you all. I know what you say about me. I know what you think about me, but I want to show you all that I can do it, and I always can do it. And she did in that moment. And just remembering all of the tears backstage. I mean, all of us were crying. I mean, even down to like stage hands. I mean, because it was so incredible, because this is a woman who had so many years of some hardship and a lot of bad press and a lot of horrible treatment by us, because we all at that point, we were laughing at her. We made her a punchline. Every single, you know, talk show, all the hosts were joking. I mean, there was just this constant smattering of mistreatment that we would never do now, you know, but that's, we were still there at that point. And so to see her come and rise above it and have that moment was so special. But it was a reminder of God, there's a different voice here, which is really lovely. And we saw it with Sparkle. And I, you know, unfortunately, that was the last that we had of her. But again, it was one of those moments of she can still do this because she's always going to sing from the heart, from her guts, you know what I mean? From the pits of her soul, she's going to always do that.
I was thinking that album, My Love Is Your Love, was going to be the thing that turned her career around. Because all these things we're talking about, where she gets to be an adult, where we get to see her pushing through the suffering, where it's a confessional, where it's clearly a sense of authorship, they were all there in that record, weren't they?
They were. And I mean, I think, you know, anybody who reads this book will very clearly learn that that is my favorite Whitney Houston album of all time. And I also think it is her absolute best. And it is specifically for that reason. We had asked this woman to show us who she was over and over and over because we never believed her. We never believed her when she said, I love these records. I want to sing these records.
Wait a second, though. Why do you think that we didn't believe her? Because go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it was the authorship question, but I also think a lot of it too, especially post I'm Your Baby Tonight. And obviously, you know, at this point we're getting, you know, she was moving into her soundtrack bag for a little while, but we were seeing what was happening in the tabloids, right? We were seeing what was going on with Bobby. So we were just like, well, I mean, what's really happening, right? Why are you not making music to that? So for her to do a film like Waiting to Exhale, which really allowed her to show us herself in an entirely different way than any other film, because this was the first film where she was not a singer. She was just a woman, you know, going through 30-something life and relationships and all of that kind of stuff. But she was also experiencing that in real life. And I think that awoken her in a particular kind of way. So I love, you know, the records we got off that soundtrack. You know, Why Does It Hurt So Bad is a favorite of mine. But that also set the tone for what she did for My Love Is Your Love. Because, you know, what people never really gave Whitney credit for was she was always ours. And she knew it. So she was always paying attention. So she was listening to hip hop. She was listening to everything. And she wasn't afraid to bring that into the fold. So when we got this record where we have these tracks with Missy and we have these tracks with Rodney Jerkins and, you know, she's given us a record like Heartbreak Hotel. I mean, my goodness, like she gave us R&B in a particular kind of way that if you think about 1998 and where the genre was headed, it was definitely towing the line between hip hop, but also really that sweetness of soul that we all loved. But it was also doing the other thing that was coming out, you know, in those late 90s, which women were really responding to what dudes were doing on rap records, right? So this is the record that we're going to have Whitney. She's going to talk her mess. You know what I mean? She's going to give us the thing. And she led us to want to think that, you know, she might be talking about Bobby, you know what I mean? Possibly, right? But it was the way that she was so playful. And these records were so, I love how biting they were. I love how cheeky some of it was. But I also loved the fact that she had a lot of attitude. She was like, no, I'm gonna remind you all of who I am. But she also showed us from the fashion perspective, how she just elevated herself and brought, you know, did the Dolce and Gabbana. I mean, she just was bad in a particular kind of way where it was like, wait a minute now, you know, but some of that, it was a reflection of, we had been calling her a diva all these years. Let me show you what it is like to be a diva in a particular kind of way, but also let me do this other thing, which is culturally, we were in still, you know, the last years of the Ghetto Fabulous era. And she dived into it because that was part of the core of who she was. And that's what I think made that album so spectacular, because it showed all the shades of Whitney, but she can also give you a beautiful pop ballad, you know, like I Bow Out, or a beautiful moment like, you know, When You Believe, which of course,
well, my favorite from the album is It's Not Right But It's Okay.
Oh my goodness, right? Just the stickiness of a record like that, like even now, I mean, we're so many years past it. You could put that record on the radio right now and it would pop. You know, I mean, there's something about the timelessness of some of it because it, you know, you're working with somebody like Rodney Jerkins, who was a little forward thinking than obviously a lot of other producers that was coming out at that time. And that's what made those records really hot in a particular kind of way.
That record where she gets to show that kind of vocal range with that kind of heavy BPM. I mean, that's And it becomes part of the tragedy of she wasn't doing a Whitney Houston quote unquote song. Nobody knew what to do with her.
Right.
And a lot of the tracks that you mentioned in the book are those kinds of things that had they been anybody else, because what we're talking about here with that song is getting a chance to sort of see just how playful she could be, but also the amount of sheer swagger there is in that song that basically says, yeah, I'm not scared of electronica. Let's go to work.
Yep. Also, really, because of the fact that she had the ability, right, to sing and to bring sort of this gospel, you know, melisma into everything she was doing, she could also then slay and completely demolish double, triple time singing. And that's what made some of those records really, 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 really incredible, because it's like, oh, wow, like, she is doing something crazy here, where it's like she's sliding on these records like a rapper would in a particular kind of way. But we also knew that that's what was happening in R&B. That's what Brandy was doing. That's what Destiny's Child was doing. That's what TLC was doing in that era. Like,
and Mary J. Blige was doing. I mean, that's basically
Mary J. Blige. You know what I mean? Like, it was all of that combined at once, where she, and I also have to think about, because she is somebody who, she brought so many women along with her. She don't get enough credit for the fact that sisterhood was at the core of who she was. So these were all women that, yes, they were part of her lineage now, because they all had studied her, but she was also hanging out with them and embracing them. These are her homegirls. So of course, you know, she's inspired by them as much as they were inspired by her. And that's what I think made that record just such a phenomenal thing. I mean, it's the one that I listen to the most. If you looked at my play count, it would be sickening, because I listen to this album probably once or twice a week, and I've done that for the last 10 plus years.
And just reading the book, Garrick, I guess I just found myself so confounded by the fact that there was this need to make her seem superficial.
Right. And I've always kind of struggled with that particular idea, because take away the gowns, take away, you know, the media training, take away all of that. She never hid, you know, nippy, which is, you know, I always like to say when she's not code switching, she's nippy, right? And so she never really hid that. Yes, you got it out of her when you poked at her, you know, when you would ask her for the 1,500th time, like, oh, well, you know, so what's really going on with Robin? Or, oh, well, why did you marry Bobby Brown? Like, you know, just these questions that she had to answer over and over and over, usually. And it's somebody white that's asking. And that you could see the irritation on her, because I also can't think of another person, another celebrity that has ever been asked on national television multiple times, not just one time, multiple times, to defend their marriage to a person, to answer why you chose to marry this man, why him of all people, what is it and what's going on? Is he cheating on you? Everywhere she went, those are the questions. Diane Sawyer is asking her that. Katie Couric is asking her that. And then, you know, when they're not satisfied with that, then it's, so what happened with, you know, you and, you know, Robin Crawford, or, you know, the other things of like, so are you really, do you like pick these songs, or does Clive just like tell you to sing them? There was this way in which we saw her as this completely manufactured thing, because of the fact that Clive, yeah, he had strategy. So that meant I'm going to service certain things. But yeah, there was also some decisions made to package her like any other artist coming out. I mean, that's also just part of how the industry works. But there was these extra licks that she took because of that. And some of that, yes, I think maybe is the family connection. But I also just think it was because we didn't see this authorship in this way that we use as sort of a barometer to validate or invalidate somebody's artistry.
By the way, the book again is Didn't We Almost Have It All? In Defense of Whitney Houston, by my guest, the very talented and thoughtful essayist and cultural commentator and author, Garrick D. Kennedy. I can't thank you enough, Garrick. Thank you for doing this.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. This is incredible.
Production staff, of course, includes Katie Gilchrist. Thank you, Katie. The show is edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.